you be in this number this morning. Folks are responding. They understand the critical nature of a free and independent media, a free press, journalism that stands up to power. This is what we're talking about. $130 to go, 800-222-9739. We want you to keep the calls coming. E. Ethelbert Miller has a fantastic show. He is interviewing the esteemed, one of the best, I would say, jazz poets of our time, poets in general, but certainly jazz poets and critics of our time, the esteemed A.B. Spellman. So you don't want to miss that. Keep the calls coming for Democracy Now, 130 to go, and for On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. 800-222-9739. The goal for this next hour is $500, and we're going to move into On the Margin. This is your station for jazz and justice, WPFW Washington.
Can't hear. With E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is A.B. Spellman. A.B. Spellman is the author of Between the Night and Its Music, a Wesley University Press book. A.B. Spellman is a well-known jazz critic. His book, Four Lives in the Bebop Business, published in 1966, is considered a classic. For several decades, A.B. Spellman worked at the National Endowment for the Arts and was honored with the establishment of the A.B. Spellman Award for Jazz Advocacy. How are you doing this morning, A.B.?
I'm doing very well, Ethelbert.
A lot to talk about.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Okay, well, this is our fundraising drive, and we'll be encouraging people to call in 202-588-9739. That's 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. AB, how has your approach to poetry changed at this point in your life?
It's changed in many ways, Ethelbert. First of all, I'm always messing with my style.
Mm-hmm.
So I make rules for myself, which I encourage people not to do as a rule. But I've decided to eliminate all punctuation.
Mm-hmm.
And I measure with caesuras, with spaces in between the words, just a way of playing with people's minds. I've also banished participles from my poetry because I think they're passive and they weaken the line. Mm-hmm. To me, I mean, I wouldn't, and I'd also never use similes. I prefer a more direct kind of image. So these are all things that I do these days, and I constantly tinker. Mm-hmm. I think also that I'm much more careful with my poems in the sense that I really do try to make sure that everything is right in the poem and that the lines always swing.
Mm-hmm.
And that the imagery is always direct and pointed and effective. And in short, I'm a better poet, a better craftsman, and I'm more confident in my voice than I was back in the 50s and 60s.
Well, when we look at this book, Between the Night and Its Music, it brings together all of your work. And I look at the really very good introduction by Lori Shire. Talk about her relationship, your relationship with her, because it seems that she's like an expert on your work. And it seems, I make at the back of the book, you call her your muse. So she's more than just a critic. She's helping you pull together. I guess she might have really put together this book with you. Talk about that collaboration.
Yeah, Laurie is a very, very knowledgeable person, a really very brilliant scholar in literature. She's written several books on Black poetry and on other poetic matters as well. She is a great anthologist. And she approached me maybe about 20 years ago and told me how much she admired my work. She started talking about it, and I found out that she knew more about my poetry than I did. She had her hands on poems that I had lost and forgotten about, years of poems, all the way back to the 50s, and had done a lot of thought about the context of the poetry and putting it in the vein of modernism in general in the lower Manhattan literary scene. And, that was a discussion that not much had had. Many people had not considered the Black poets of my generation as being active in modernism, in poetic innovation. Laurie was actually did an entire anthology on that subject. Mm-hmm. So she stated a commitment to my work and said she would do anything she could to help promote it. And mm-hmm. so we developed a relationship, and that started sending her poems, and she sent comments back on them, and she got very much involved in it. And so she actually holds basically my library.
You know, what I found interesting, and you were talking about this with my first, your response, my first question about form and structure. When I look at Laurie Shire's work and her anthology, she has a real interest in African-American experimental writers.
Yes.
And I was wondering whether she saw, well, A.B. is experimenting. Let me talk to him. Did she see you as an experimental writer also?
She did. And she picked out several of my more adventurous poems for her anthology on the subject. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole coterie of scholars who've looked at this period and look at it very closely, and they're actually kind of scary, mm-hmm. because I mean they have stuff that I had long forgotten about. Mm-hmm. There was a little newsletter that Baraka started just at the period when he was sort of divesting himself from the Lower Manhattan art scene and preparing himself to move uptown. He started a little newsletter called In/Formation. Mm-hmm. Very clever title. And we were writing like revolutionary essays on the political events of the time. And I think there were only like about maybe three issues put out. And it was a little mimeograph thing. You remember the Gestetner mimeograph?
Right.
Which was all basic internet.
You also had some poems in a publication called The Floating Bear.
Yeah, that's right. I started that magazine with Diane DePrima. Mm-hmm. And we had a disagreement. I wanted it to be open, and we'd take whatever came in. Diane said, no, we got to have standards. She was right. I was wrong. I left it to her after a while, and she took it forward. It was a very important little mimeograph sheet. I mean, just things that people get in the mail. I mean, there's nothing you could do to sell it, but it was mm-hmm. something we just print up and send out.
Right. You know, when you said about Laurie working with your work, I've warned me, and also discovering poems that you might have forgotten about, have you, in terms of putting together this book, Between the Night and His Music, did you go back and revise some of your earlier work?
I did. I really don't like those poems so much these days because, I mean, as I say, I'm a much better poet now than mm-hmm. I was then. And I look at those poems and say, oh, man, how did I let this get by? So I went back and fixed some of them. That was something Laurie didn't really want me to do because as a scholar, she's interested in what it was,
right.
Original, authentic version. But there were times when I said, no, this poem could be a lot better if I just did this and this and this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I want you to, share with our listeners, two poems, Dear John Coltrane and Grooving Low. But I also want to first ask you to answer a question. In terms of the jazz poem, if you were conducting a workshop, what might you encourage people to avoid doing in terms of a jazz poem?
Okay, I have to ask what you mean by a jazz poem.
Okay, when we look at jazz poems, okay, sometimes we call it a jazz poem because there's a reference to a jazz musician. Okay, uh-huh. Sometimes we call it because the poem is trying to imitate jazz in terms of structure. Uh-huh. Okay, sometimes it's the title is from a jazz album. Yeah, but it has that sort of jazz component. Or sometimes, for example, a person is reading a poem to jazz. Uh-huh. You know, like how Langston was doing it one time. Somebody would say, oh, this is like jazz poetry because he's reading to jazz.
Right.
So I'm just using those terms. But it's obvious that there's things where someone would say, this isn't working. Yeah, I remember, for example, Baraka said something about Michael Harper's poem, and he called it was spineless. I guess it didn't swing,
So, well, I look at each poem when I have a workshop individually, and I look at see what the poet is trying to do, and I try to see if I can help the poet get to what he or she intends to do. A lot of times, people will use jazz as metaphor. Mm-hmm. And certainly that can work, but it has to work well. You can't just mention like Miles blowing a trumpet solo and think
all the jazz poems.
Yeah, right. You know, you can't just do that. You have to as in everything that goes in your poem, everything that goes in your poem should be something that is of you. Mm-hmm. So unless you have taken and absorbed this phenomenon and gotten it so much that it becomes a part of your statement itself, then it's hard to make it work in the poem. So I would encourage people, as I would on any subject, not to be superficial about it.
I see.
The main thing is how into jazz are you, how in you is jazz? And if that is so, if it is deeply in you, then it will come out in the poem quite naturally.
Would it make a difference if a person was skillful at playing an instrument?
Well, if a person was skillful at playing an instrument, that would give that person greater insight into the music because they would know more about how it is made. Mm-hmm. And they could talk about that. But of course, that person would have to be also skillful at writing.
Right. Well, you're skillful at writing. So why don't you share with us, you know, Dear John Coltrane and Groovin' Low.
Okay. Dear John Coltrane is a poem that I wrote in a hotel room in Boston. Hotel rooms are great for writing poetry, you know. You're out of town and you don't have the distractions and you're all by yourself and your thoughts come to you in a very clean way. And it was the experience of first listening to a radio station which was playing a J.S. Bach keyboard concerto. I'm a great lover of Bach. Bach and John Coltrane are the two musicians who most often have sort of transported me, and you know what I mean by that.
Right.
And so I've had the greatest experiences in music from those two musicians. Okay, so first I heard Bach on the radio, and then later I went to a different station and heard John Coltrane playing Train Slow Blues, which is a very neglected John Coltrane masterpiece. All right. Dear John Coltrane, dead night has me writing poetry in another hotel room. J.S. Bach is on the radio, the keyboard concerto in F minor, the one you also hear on oboe or violin. The Largo second movement begins and the book in my hand drops. The room fades. And I put my reason down to trail the Bach of endless line along this earthless path, each note full and bright, a brilliant footprint on the dark. Through beauty, past knowledge, into that state that shines too much to be wisdom, is too transparent to be art. I catch a fear of the place where he will lure me when this transporting melody closes. Then it closes on itself, and here I am, dear John, back at the beginning, better. Later, different station, cold room dimming. It's you, John, Train Slow Blues. Now it's your line that opens and opens and opens, and I'm flying that way again. Same sky, different moon, this midnight globe that toned those now lost blue rooms where things like jazz float the mind. This motion, the still and airless propulsion I know as inner flight. This view, the one I cannot see with my eyes open. I hear the beginning approach, and I know the line I travel was a horizon, the circle of the world, another freedom flight to another starting place. If I believed in heaven, I would ask if you, JC, and Bach ever swap infinite fours and jam the sound that light makes going and coming, and if you exchange maps to those exclusive clouds you travel through, and do you give them names?
A.B. Spellman reading his poem, Dear John Coltrane, from his book, Between the Night and His Music. You know, that last line, A.B., do you give them names? I think about how this poem deals with what people, jazz musicians, would say, okay, we're not playing jazz, we're playing black classical music.
Right.
And I like how, if a listener was looking at the poem on the page, using jamming, almost like the changing of the station. So it's like the second stanza is the second it's a change of the station.
Right, exactly. So yeah, the thing is I tend to use more than one theme in poems. I don't know why, but often I find that my poems find consonant subjects to discuss.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, you know what I think is interesting in this poem is what you said earlier when you were introducing it. You're listening in a hotel and not in your home. And I think there's a big difference. You know, I think if you're at home, you listen to, you might listen even more deeply, but the thing in terms of sometimes you're away and there's a longing when you hear music that you might remember something, it takes you back home or something. But you know, because it's in a hotel and not a home, it's a big difference. And that first line sets it up.
Yeah, you're detached from your natural environment and you're put into a strange one, but you're also more isolated. That allows for better concentration in a way. That sort of frees up some things too, because a lot of the things that are associated with home aren't with you and they aren't affecting you. But in a hotel, you know, your mind can maybe, you know, get more into this new trip that it wants to take at a point.
And you also highlight the fact that we should look at Coltrane the way we look at Bach.
Definitely. Nina Simone said, talking about her favorite musician, said, well, okay, I got to give it to Bach.
Right, okay.
I do encourage a lot of people listen only to jazz, but really jazz Bach is somebody no one should deprive themselves of.
Okay. Well, on that note, so we don't deprive, I'm going to bring in Katiste, who you know.
Oh, yeah. No one should deprive
me. Yeah, we were going to talk about Nina Simone, but we're talking about Katia, okay?
Right. Okay.
Katia, you want to talk this morning? Say hello to AB?
Absolutely want to say hello to AB, of course. AB, congratulations on the publishing of your book. It's so beautiful. Like, can't wait to get my copy. And Ethelbert, thank you for always having stellar guests on. And today is certainly no exception. And so we want to implore everyone, we don't want to deprive people of the opportunity to support such excellence, such Black excellence this morning. As we look at the rollback of DEI and Black history, we have Black history right here on our air this morning with E. Ethelbert Miller, the esteemed poet, and A.B. Spellman, the esteemed poet and music critic. And so you understand the mission. You know that this is the kind of radio, this is the kind of listening experience that you've come to expect from On the Margin and from WPFW. So now is the time. Now's the time to make that call that makes the difference, 800-222-9739. Our goal is $500 this hour, and we can do that together, folks. Many hands do indeed make light work. And we don't want to really take up a lot of time asking for your support. But, you know, to keep us free, and we want to stay free, we need your support to keep having this kind of insightful and beautiful, just beautiful discussion and exchange. We need your support. It's simple as that. And this is your way of being in solidarity with us. This is your way of resisting the erasure of African-American History Month or Black History or DEI. This is your way to step up and say, no, I won't let that happen by supporting this program On the Margin. 800-222-9739, WPFWFM.org, the ways to connect, $500 to go. And Ethelbert and AB, I'd be most honored if I could return to you and thank some folks after this next segment.
Okay. And as we get into this next section, I think this is good for you, AB, to re-groove and low.
Well, first let me say that in the first year of WBFW, I did a radio show for a couple of years there until the National Endowment for the Arts made me stop doing it because BFW was eligible to apply and that would be conflict of interest. But I had a show called In Defense of the Blue. Which I really enjoyed doing. I think it went well. PFW is more important than people realize in this time because there's not a whole lot left of the kind of voices in the public air like WPFW, and you can see that in this course in these days,
right,
that the forces are trying to diminish that voice more and more and more. So they're trying to, let's not make it less. Let's make
right.
it more.
Okay.
Grooving Low. Grooving Low, the PFW audience will recognize the title as a play on the Dizzy Gillespie tune Grooving High. an old bebop tune. But whatever Dizzy was talking about, this one was about aging. And it is very much founded in jazz. I'll give a couple of glosses. I talk about the weird words in the second stanza are drum patterns. I didn't make them up. I say when the rhythm locks, that's the point at which the bass and the drum really hook up and become like one statement with two tones in it. I won't bother any more references. I think everybody can get the point. Grooving low. My swing is more mellow these days. Not the hard bop drive I used to roll, but more of a cool foxtrot. My eyes still close when the rhythm locks. I've learned to boogie with my feet on the floor. I'm still moving, still grooving, still falling in love. I bop to the bass line now. The trap set paradiddles, radamacues, and flams still set me off. But I bop to the bass line now. I enter the tune from the bottom up and let trumpet and sax wheel above me. So, don't look for me in the treble. Don't look for me in the fly staccato splatter of the hot young horn, no. You'll find me in the nuance, hanging out in inflection and slur. I'm the one executing the half-bent dip in the slow drag with the smug little smile and the really cool shades.
A.B. Spellman reading Grooving Low from his book Between the Night and Its Music. A.B., one of the things I liked about this, if this was like a workshop poem, in the first stanza, the vowels, you know, boogie with my feet on the floor. I love that. And then in the second, you have a lot of alliteration. But then you close with and the really cool shades. And I thought about how many times, you know, we talk about jazz musicians, music and stuff, but it's also their dress. And I was thinking of the poem by Larry Neal, Don't Say Goodbye to the Pork Pie Hat.
Right.
Which I had read when Howard University Press published Larry Neal's book, right? And I said, why are they publishing Larry Neal's book? But then Baraka came to Howard and read that poem, and it was like, you know, I wouldn't go out and get a pork pie hat, you know, because you realize, you know, how much musicians, you know, I'm thinking about Monk, others, their dress. And then one time you had to have shades if you're going to be cool and listen to
jazz. Exactly.
Yeah. So did you have your shades back in the day?
Actually, I never really had a really cool shade, but in the poem, I thought I needed them.
And you don't seem to be a hat man.
No, I wear caps now. I do have hats. I went back to hats the other birthday.
Oh, you went back to hats.
I've got hats now. I went back to them.
Did you tell Lori's child that you went back to hats?
No, but I tell you, there's a hat. I have a Baraka. I had a hat when I was at Howard that Baraka hated. I went to Howard. I had this. I won't try to not take too much time with this story.
Right.
But I had shopped as of my freshman year from Elizabeth City, North Carolina. My idea of fashion, I got on the Ebony magazine ads. So I shopped all summer for this outfit to wear to Howard. I had like a coat. The jacket was like a zoot suit jacket.
A zoot suit.
Yeah, it was like big wide shoulders, flared down tight at the hips. One button roll with big lapels and was blue and white houndstooth. The pants were sky blue peg pants with a dark navy stitch down the seam. And I had shoes with some alligator suede. And I had this hat. And I met Baraka and his boys, and they were from Newark. And I thought that Newark must be the coolest place in the world to produce dudes like this. So I started hanging out with him. I don't know why he took me in, because I was pretty country. But he let me know I couldn't dress like that and hang with him, because everybody was wearing Ivy League clothes, and I'm in this suit outfit. So, but this hat, he hated this hat that I used to wear. And one drunken night, he snatched it off my head and went running across campus, and I'm chasing him. And it went down past the library, and I said, okay, he's going over to the girls' dorm, so I'll cut to the right and cut him off. But no, he cut left and went to the reservoir, and he threw my hat into the reservoir. After bringing in my memory, the hat floated across the sky like a flying saucer, paused before a full moon, and then descended onto the water where it floated for a while until it eventually sank. And I think of people all over D.C. drinking out of my hat today.
AB, you sound like you're creating folklore on the air.
You know? That's a true story, Ethelbert.
Okay.
But stories like that don't make the biographies, though.
All right. Well, let's go back. I mean, and you brought up Baraka. I want to go back to when he was Leroy Jones. And I also want to go back to this. And I said before we went on the air, I want you to look at three periods. I want you to go back and look at the poetics of the 50s, and then also look at the Black Arts Movement, and then bring it all the way up to Furious Flower.
Okay. During the 50s, when I first followed Baraka to New York, I got there in 1957, I was, and most all of us were, including Baraka, really concerned with techniques of poetry and fundamental poetry aesthetics. Major influence of William Carlos Williams and all the Imagists and everybody who came out of that, you know, including people like Ginsberg and so forth.
The New Jersey crowd.
New Jersey crowd, that's right. The Black Mountain poets were very influential in my life. And so Robert Creeley was a big influence on me in those days, probably the biggest. So I'm really concerned with things like, where does the line break? Does it break according to breath, or does it break according to the grammar? Or is there some like visual effect? Right.
And breath was the one that Ginsberg was very strong on that.
Very strong, very much so, because he was more out of, he was out of Williams, but also out of Whitman.
Mm-hmm.
And Whitman was trying to be like an opera diva. He wanted a big voice. So breath was very, very, very important in that. So I'm concerned with things like that. Then Malcolm X appeared, and it took us all by storm. We were all very much affected, of course, by what was happening with the Civil Rights Movement. And then there was a big anti-war movement. But, you know, we were very much affected by, especially the more militant of them, like SNCC, was very important to us. So we listened to Stokely Carmichael.
You interviewed Malcolm X, if I'm not mistaken.
I met him at a UN reception, and I introduced myself to him because he had just left the nation and was starting this organization. I wanted to see if I could possibly work with him. So I said, I introduced myself to him. He said, okay, what do you do? I said, well, I'm a poet. He said,
what do you do?
He said, what kind of poetry do you write? You know, and I thought, I didn't know how to answer the question. I'm babbling. He said, who do you write for? I had never thought about that.
Mm.
You know, I mean, I had some politics, but I had never thought about my poetry and the politics. And I get back home, get out my Sterling Brown, so I figure out how I could write poetry that might reach a Harlem audience, you know. But that was Malcolm was a big influence on how we thought about things. And so,
you know, what you just said almost outlined the Black Arts Movement in terms of what art, you know, who you're writing for, you know, audience.
Yeah, those are the issues we had to deal with, and it required turning around in a lot of ways, because I'm thinking only of the page, but now it's really quite obvious that the poetry, the vocal poetry, is going to be very important, performance poetry. I never was good at it.
Mm-hmm. Hold that point right there, because you're saying the oral. Could this be the difference between you and Leroy Jones Baraka, where he goes into the theater, he starts writing plays?
Yeah, he's writing plays. I never did that. I never could do that. I never tried either.
But you were also in the drama department at Howard.
At Howard, I was.
You snuck over there.
Yeah, I did. I was very much in it. And Owen Dawson was my biggest faculty influence at Howard.
But you never thought about writing any plays?
I never did. It never appealed to me. The idea never did. I don't have a reason for that. But it's not just something I've not thought of doing. I'm about to write. I've written a libretto now, and I'm about to write another one with a composer named Jeff Scott. who set my poems and music in that record that won the Grammy last year. Mm-hmm. The passion for Coltrane and Bach, for Bach and Coltrane, rather. But at any rate, it was this kind of germination that begins the Black art poetry aesthetic, because now audience is very much in the creation of the art. Whereas before, you're thinking, the painters are thinking more plastically. They're thinking only of what you can do on a canvas, technically and with their visual imagination. But now, of course, they have to go back, and as the painters of the Harlem Renaissance did, and try to think about some imagery that would deal with heritage and with the politics of Black oppression and Black liberation. So that was a major thing that informed the
Well, let's stop right there, and then we're going to take a little break, and we're going to come back. My guest this morning is A.B. Spellman, and he's been talking about his career as a poet. He's been reading from his book, Between the Night and Its Music, a Wesleyan University Press book. The show's On the Margin with the Ethelbert Miller, Decision Study PFW 89.3 FM.
From 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., Sankofa Video and Books presents the memoirs of Robert and Mabel Williams, African-American freedom, armed resistance, and international solidarity, located at Sankofa Video Books and Cafe, 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. For more info, visit Sankofa.com. On Sunday, August 17th, from 3 to 5 p.m., join Palestinian poet Paul Katafago to discuss his book, The Palestinian Freedom Now Suite, at the American Poetry Museum, 716 Monroe Street, number 25, Northeast DC. Also on Sunday, August 17th, from 5 to 7 p.m., attend Peace or Profit, a Mukuba film screening, presented by Friends of the Congo at Busboys and Poets on 14th and V Street, Northwest Washington, D.C. For more info, visit busboysandpoets.com. Finally, on Sunday, August 17th, from 7 to 9 p.m., The Politics of Kenya, Post-Colonial Kenya, discussion will take place at Sankofa Video Books and Cafe, 2714 Georgia Avenue, Northwest Washington, D.C. For more info, visit sankofa.com. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar connects you to grassroots activism in the DMV. Submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of the event. This is due by Thursday at 5 p.m., at least 1 week in advance of your event. Consider making a donation to support WPFW's Summer Pledge Drive by calling 800-222-9739. That's 800-222-9739. WPFW's Social Justice Calendar helps build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Katia, do you want to say anything?
I absolutely do, Ethelbert. We have some folks to thank. We want to thank Anonymous, out of McLean, Virginia, who says they're in solidarity. And if I could just back up for a moment and go back to Democracy Now! For a moment. We also want to thank Adrian out of Falls Church, Virginia. And I don't know if I said thank you to Anonymous out of Chevy Chase, saying thanks for what you do. Thank you both for your pledges to Democracy Now! And going back to your pledges, Ethelbert, we want to thank Anonymous out of Silver Spring, Maryland. We want to thank Stephen out of Washington, D.C. Thank you so much. Anonymous out of Ellicott City, Maryland, says, "Music is my religion." That is a quote from Jimi Hendrix. And I think A.B., Ethelbert, and myself would all concur with you. Music is our religion as well. Maybe poetry, too. And finally, we want to thank Deanna Douglas out of Mount Rainier. She says, "Thank you, WPFW, for all you do. Love Ethelbert Miller's show. It is a gift." And yes, it is a gift. So please keep the calls coming for On the Margin. You can help us to make and exceed this goal right now. The number to call, 800-222-9739. We want to double the goal this morning if we can. 800-222-9739. I also want to mention one last thing. Ethelbert, you and A.B. Continue to reference Amiri Baraka, and we just want to let our listeners know that in our downloadable digipack Black August, Black Liberation DigiPack, there is an entire, I think it's at least 10 entries, an entire Mary Baraka collection. And it moves you through where he was Leroy Jones, beat poet in the village, to Mary Baraka. And so it's a fascinating listen to it in the order as he, found that revolutionary spirit that we all know and love. From coming from Leroy Jones to that. So that's yours for a pledge of $130. It's downloadable. It can be shared again and again. Again, it's an education. It's liberatory in its scope, and it is for everybody. This is American history. You know, Black August is American history. Black liberation is American history and American liberation. So the number to call, 800-222-9739. Please keep the calls coming for Ethelbert. We want to make sure he makes his goal this morning. They have such a beautiful program. Back to you, Ethelbert.
AB, I want to get back to this Black Arts Movement. Are there any poets from the Black Arts Movement that you feel are like overlooked? You know, I was thinking of people like Yusuf Rahman. I'm thinking of even Callan Rogers to the extent that more people should be looking at their work. You know, me people think about Haki Madhubuti, Sonia Sanchez, but there are other writers that are very important when we look nationally.
I think Amos Moore.
Amos Moore, right. Out of Chicago.
Yeah, out of Chicago. I think he was a great poet. The best stand-up poet I ever saw. He had a command and performance that you just could not avoid. And his lines flowed so well and were so natural and were so rooted that it wasn't somebody who was trying to be Black in any way. It was just that it was so organic in his expression. The Coming of John, the poem about the coming of John Coltrane,
right.
I think is a classic poet. Yeah, I think a lot of Amos Moore.
Yeah, that poem I think is in Quincy Troost's Giant Talk anthology.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Anybody else come to mind?
Well, see, that's the thing, Ethelbert. You called me by surprise, and then all of a sudden I'm blank. My mind is going blank. What's the name? Another guy from Chicago.
Is Royster?
He died in his early 30s.
David Lorenz? Not David Lorenz.
Oh, God.
Okay, we'll get back.
I'm blanking.
Okay. Well, no, let's bring it up to you were being honored last year at the Fierce Flower. Mm-hmm. And I want you to read The Woman I Have Not Slept With, because everybody was getting into that poem. and I want to want you to read that poem, but also talk about the importance of humor, because you mentioned Sterling Brown's name a couple of times in this program. And when I think of Sterling Brown, I thought of the lies that he told in between the poems. But his poems also was a person, if you were studying poetry, say, oh, there's a place for humor.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And I say that at a time when people are saying, oh, I'm going to write this Black militant poem and get white people, but
right,
but
right,
there was a sense of being, okay, you can laugh and be militant,
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Sterling Brown was a person who very much appreciated Black culture and all aspects. And one aspect he appreciated very much was the great oral tradition of lying, of just standing out and turning the biggest swappers you possibly could. The time I went to his house, he told one, I wish I had taken notes on lying.
on lying.
A giant lie. I know it ended with, and that's when that German woman shot W.B. Du Bois in the ass with a .22 pistol. That's the only thing. I wish I had that story told. But yeah, Sterling Brown that's the thing. I mean, when we talk about Blackness, we sometimes forget that we laugh a lot too,
mm-hmm.
And that is an aspect of the community that keeps us sane.
You know, I think when you say that, I think of how popular Percival Everett has become with his novel James, because that's a very funny novel.
I haven't read it yet.
Yeah, that's a very funny novel.
It's on my shelf.
Let's hear. Your poem, The Women I Have Not Slept With.
Okay.
And maybe somebody will call in and say, well, AB, do you remember me?
Well, there have been a couple.
And make a pledge.
And make a pledge. Oh, you're just pimping this morning, Kitty.
But I'm not going to come over and sleep because you made the pledge, so don't expect that. Okay, the women I have not slept with, I think I have that memorized. I have them in order here, but you changed the order on me.
That's all improvisation, AB.
Well, okay, I'll try from memory. The women I have not slept with. This poem, I've had some people who, some friends who have written tell-all memoirs. And that's an imperative that I really don't understand, you know, why somebody would want to do that. So this poem is dedicated to my friends who've written tell-all memoirs. And it's called The Women I Have Not Slept With. They number in the billions, and that's if you only count the living. For example, I have not slept with Sarah Palin, and not because she shoots large mammals for fun. No, I have not slept with her because she's too far right, and I'm too far left, and there's too much miscegenation to arouse. Nor have I slept with Hillary Clinton. I had a shot at Hillary and have the photograph to prove it. That's me shaking hands with her, head cocked to the side, a mating signal in every primate male. And I thought I saw something in the curl of her mouth, but the line was pushing at my back there in the gold room and I couldn't make my move. But we'll see, we'll see. I have not slept with Madonna. Before you get the impression that I've only not slept with white women, I haven't slept with Oprah either. No fault of hers, no fault of mine. We just never hooked up. Never made it with Vanessa Williams, and that one hurts. She once split from a sexual fantasy I was having. Took one look at my admittedly adipose body and disappeared from my fantasy and wouldn't come back. Broke my tumescent heart. And then there's Chaka Khan. Sweet, sweet, sweet Chaka, the lust of my life. I did get to hug her once, a nice belly-to-belly rub, but my boss was in the room and nothing came of it. She sent me a box of chocolates. And so it goes, or it doesn't. If I have not slept with you and didn't mention you, please don't be offended. I thought you deserved your own poem.
A.B. Spellman reading his poem, The Women I Have Not Slept With. You know, when you read that poem down in Madison, James Madison University, a whole generation of poets, you know, they got up, they gave you a standing ovation. Talk about, you know, meeting some of these young poets. I mean, Fewer Flowers is an institution and hundreds of poets get together, there. You listen to a lot of poems. Did you see a change? I mean, we had people who were doing spoken word down there. We had people who were, you know, from the Caribbean, from Africa. What was your take in terms of being one of the older people there?
Yeah, I think I probably was the oldest person there.
I was sitting next to you, Oprah.
you're just a kid.
Thank you.
Yeah. First of all, I would say that Black poetry is in better shape than it's ever been. Mm. I mean, there were some killer poets. There are a lot of them. Mm. You know, there were six Pulitzer Prize winning poets there. Mm. And these were based, they were all men. Now, which I find a little curious because there are some.
And Rita Dove was there.
And Rita Dove, yeah, right, that's right, yeah. But there's some brilliant women poets out there too, but there were like more than a dozen poets laureate there,
right,
from various states and cities, and just a whole mass of really strong poets, people who are writing in all different kinds of styles. The Caribbean poets were very interesting to me, because they have a sort of a natural lyricism that is in their culture. Our language here, in the mainland is pretty much like functional. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't sing naturally. So as poets, we have to find the musical qualities in the language and apply them to the poets' poems. But these Caribbean poets, you know, I know from many experiences down there, is that there's a lyricism in the syntax and then the vocalization that just feeds right into poetry.
Well, let me ask you this question, A.B. Were you, when you like 50s and 60s, were you influenced by, say, Aimé Césaire, Léon Damas?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And also Braithwaite.
Braithwaite, right.
Yeah. I was very much influenced by all of them. They were the ones who, the negative movement was a very strong movement, mm-hmm. and it isn't given enough examination today.
Right.
I mean, people need to be, younger people getting into literature need to be aware of what the negritude poets did.
Well, you know, when you say that, I look at when I was at Howard, I knew about the Harlem Renaissance New Negro Movement, but I felt that it was language that separated me from embracing, the Francophone poets, where one person who I wish I had more of a conversation with, I wonder whether you did, because he would come up to my office, but I didn't really have a sense of him. And that was Mercer Cook.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I took classes with Mercer Cook.
See, talk about Mercer Cook, because he's definitely, I mean, he was the son of Will Marion Cook, because he used to write mm-hmm. with Dunbar.
Yeah, he was a very good man, a brilliant man. Had a very gentle style about him, mm-hmm. Very accessible. I know I was studying voice as an elective in those days, and I had a recital. And I invited him to, and he came, and he gave me commentary on his recital, and he told me about Will Marion Cook, whom I knew nothing of at that time, and about what his importance was. But he was a man. There was a group, a discussion group that lasted a while there with faculty and students, where they talk about books.
Hmm.
I remember I represented Camus. Novel about Algeria. What is the one?
The Stranger or
The Stranger?
Stranger.
Yeah. I led the discussion on that one, and he was there, and he contributed a lot to the conversation, which helped me understand it more. Mm-hmm. And he also was, took time to be very complimentary on me as a student who was trying to read seriously. So he encouraged intellectual development very much. He was a really good man.
Mm.
A lot of good faculty influences at Howard at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there's still a lot.
Were you influenced by any of the people in the philosophy department? I'm thinking of Banner, McAllister.
No, I took one course in philosophy. It was not. I read a lot of philosophy, but I didn't read it. Pursue it in any class. I largely read the existentialists.
Mm-hmm.
That was the thought that I was very much affected by. Interestingly enough, shortly thereafter, the civil rights movement, particularly SNCC, emptied the philosophy department.
Hmm.
All students left there, and when the Stokely Carmichael.
Stokely Carmichael, he was a philosophy major.
Yeah, he was a philosophy major. So was Jenkins.
Timothy Jenkins.
He was a philosophy major, and a couple of others. Mm. Went down there, and there was some of the members of the students in the department also were poets. That was sort of
let's move as we get toward the end of our show. Let's move from poetry to painting, because in your new book, that we've been hearing from today, Between the Night and Its Music, you have a series of suite of poems on Van Gogh.
Uh-huh.
Talk about and if you can read the poem Self-Portrait, 1887. But talk about your interest in Van Gogh, what you learned from him as a writer.
Well, first of all, Van Gogh is everybody's favorite painter for very good reason, because he is first as the founder of Expressionism. He is someone who put the entire being into painting.
Mm-hmm.
He was not governed by technical advancement or formal advancement in painting, but he was primarily concerned with expression. And so his paintings always look different. The brush strokes were obvious, you know, were out front. And there was so that it indicated the act of painting itself was important to him. He was a miserable man. No woman who wasn't related to him ever loved him as hard as he tried. And he also had his mind ruined, and his mind was always fragile, but it was ruined by the fact that he had venereal diseases for most of his life. And his brother died that way as well. So, Van Gogh is a powerful, powerful painter. Everybody who is open to being moved by what one sees is moved by Van Gogh.
Well, talk about you have 9 poems that make up this Van Gogh suite. How did you conceptualize this series? Did you spend a lot of time looking at paintings? Did you know you were working on a series of poems, or did they develop into a series once you got started?
Barry, I got to take 1 second because I didn't pull this poem out. I'm sorry. Let me grab the book.
Okay, that's on page 108.
Okay, thank you. Van Gogh. First of all, I read a biography of Van Gogh by Stephen Nyafe, and I forget the co-author of it. It was a powerful biography, and I went back and reread the letters. His letters to his brother Theo. Mm-hmm. And those are powerful as well. They're so immediate. And so
are you doing this over a period of time, like years or this?
No, actually I read the biography and then I thought, oh boy, I started identifying poems that were in the biography.
Okay. So
I had not thought to do this before, but you read something, you say, oh yeah, right. there's a poem in this text right here. And you go and make it. But as I said, I then went back to the letter for some other references. So it was a pleasure to write about Van Gogh, and there was a lot of material there to choose from. I might have been able to make a whole book out of it if I had worked at it long enough.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear the self-portrait, 1887.
Okay. This, my face, describes the mythic tragedy of mirrors. I have set my portrait in the expressive gestures of the brush, so that This, my face, describes the mythic tragedy of mirrors. I have set my portrait in the expressive gestures of the brush. No flat space disputes the inherent violence of sight. I did not pretend it was God's surface, smooth and clean and classic like Degas, but laid it on levé, modeled, so no moment of your inspection is serene. This face was not crafted in thoughtful sequences. Nothing is tranquil, not my rough wool coat, not the leopard skin background, not the blaze that spreads from my beard to my lobe and up into the hair that I cut myself. There is a nervous light across my forehead that dims its way down the line of my nose, where the inner conflagration, the nostril vents, soon will set my head on fire. I have known the hell of burning all my life, but the goddamn mirror will not let me call it peace. The topology here is parlous. A rufous absinthe mound rises below the promontory eyebrows to shade green viper eyes that condemn you for the pretense of your squiritude. I set out to paint the eyes of a bonze in profound meditation, but the glass could not find them and offered mine instead. It knows what lives inside these orbs and the scathing light that flares out of them, and why they are at home in a face on fire.
A.B. Spellman reading his poem Self-Portrait, 1887. This is a poem that I think as soon as you finish reading it, A.B., you want to go and look at the painting. You know, it works very well. And maybe this, Katia, do you have anything you want to say as we get to the end of our program?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you and especially A.B. for bringing this beauty forth, because it is exactly the balm we need right now. Thank you, A.B. We love you, of course. And thank you, E. Ethelbert Miller, intuition to present such a beautiful program this morning. And we want to thank a bunch of folks that helped us make our goal this morning. So we want to thank Anonymous in honor of Faith Davis Ruffins, and she was a longtime supporter and major donor for WPFW. Thank you so much, Anonymous.
And indeed, we want to continue to thank folks. We want to say thank you to Michael out of Silver Spring. And he says, please thank Ethelbert for covering all the bases on the outfield, too. Reference to your baseball book. That's wonderful, Ethelbert. The number to call, 800-222-9739-WPFWFM.org are the ways to connect. Let's keep it going. Keep it going. You all have responded so beautifully this morning. 800-222-9739 or WPFWFM.org are the ways to connect to support On the Margin. Of course, coming up next, before we'll go back to Ethelbert, but after that, coming up is The Collision. And of course, you got to be ready to support The Collision. 800-222-9739, WPFWFM.org. Keep the calls coming for On the Margin. I'm going to return now to E. Ethelbert Miller.
Can A.B. read one more poem?
Absolutely.
Okay. A.B., it's a poem that I didn't request you to read, but I think it would be nice to end the program with. Okay. You have a poem entitled Evening Again for Karen?
Evening Again?
Yeah, that you wrote for your wife.
Yeah, you have a page number for it?
Yeah, it's page 163. I thought that would be nice.
Beautiful. See, A.B., see, Ethelbert?
A great woman, my wife.
We know that.
Yes, indeed.
By the way, while I'm searching for this page, I want people to know that I myself pledge at every drive. I try to anyway.
Yes.
And the thing about Ethelbert's show is that every time I hear it, I learn something.
Well, I learned a lot today from this show.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, that's my biggest compliment is to tell people I learn from them. And I always learn from your shows. Okay, Evening Again. For Karen. I remind myself that it is only evening, and of course the sun has thinned the light. I remind myself that it is only evening, and of course the sun has thinned its light. That darkness calls the city poem to be. The swollen generations who fill the day close with the light and start their search for love enough to still the rolling bass line that swings a maudlin blues. Note that in no known light do name things rhyme today, that we must be contented with a tender assonance with those we call in our true voices, as the evening song, neither new nor better, hums and strums along. I write these lines because I want a record of or for my spirit as it turns and starts for home, of the way it tuned itself to sing the evening song, a voice at ease among its strings and frets, secure in knowing that love enough awaits to tell the difference between the silver chords I know as home and the plain song of the blues evaders. This is my current definition of love. You sing and are sung of. I hear and am heard.
Oh, A.B., thank you for that. And, you know, I'm going to tease you because, you know, you did both poems where you said, well, let me start again. I said, that sounds like the blues. I mean, you say the line twice. So I want to thank you. I want to thank you for that. And thank you for being my guest. You're just a treasure, A.B., in terms of what you mean, you know, to African-American culture, what you mean to our music, what you mean to this station. And so I just want to, you know, thank you for being my guest. My guest this morning has been A.B. Spellman, the author of Between the Night and Its Music, a Western University Press book. A.B. is a well-known jazz critic. His book, Four Lives in the Bebop Business, is considered a classic. And for many years, he worked for the National Endowment for the Arts. Okay, that's the end of our program.